Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 217, Sutra, Tantra, and the Buddha's Higher Educations.
So a sutra is the speech of a Buddha, but in the Buddhist system of education, the sutra basket, or the texts of the Buddhist sutras, or the memorization of them, if they're not written, corresponds among the different three sets of texts to the education in samadhi, or education in mind. You know, the Vinaya corresponds to the ethical education. The sutra corresponds to the mental education, or the samadhi education. And the Abhidharma text corresponds to the wisdom education. And I always prefer to say education than training. The three trainings, I call them the three higher educations that the Buddha left to human beings from his insight. So when you hear the Buddhist sutra in any language, the Buddha is sharing his field of awareness with us. And so we're temporarily taken up in the Buddha's field of awareness. And as you may have noticed in the Heart Sutra, he was saying things like, these are the perfect signs or marks of a Buddha. And there are no signs and marks of a Buddha. There is a Buddha, and there's no Buddha. So many contradictions, he is saying. And what he means by that, he doesn't mean, but that unfortunately can be easily misunderstood as a kind of nihilistic idea that everything has no meaning. And somehow you can say anything. And that's absolutely wrong. What he means by that is that there are different perspectives in the mind, and the Buddha's mind is able to encompass all these different perspectives, even opposition, completely aware of both sides. So both sides are completely meaningful, if you follow me. From the point of view of the conventional reality, there are signs of a Buddha, there's the presence of a Buddha, there's non-Buddhas, sentient beings, etc., etc. From the point of view of the real reality, ultimate reality, it's all one field of reality, free of suffering, free of Buddhas, free of sentient beings, simply a field of bliss, freedom, bliss void, bliss emptiness, indivisible, something like that. And a Buddha's mind is a mind that encompasses what I sometimes call extreme form of cognitive dissonance, both sides of such an opposition. And this is shocking to us because we can only hold one side of something at one time. We're either awake or asleep. And we therefore assume that some enlightened state is some kind of simple state. You know, like, and actually, unfortunately, I think we model it too much on our idea of a sleep state. Because that's the only time when we're really happy. When you're sound asleep, you have no problem, right? Until you dream, of course. But otherwise, so we unconsciously, we think, that enlightened being must be always like that, no problem. And even they say Buddha has no problem, Buddha is blissful. But on the other hand, and that's the wisdom of Buddha, knowing the reality of everything is pure nirvana. You know, the Four Noble Truths, of those four, the only one that's really real is the third one, nirvana. Buddha's real discovery was nirvana. It's very easy to discover suffering. It doesn't take a Buddha. Everybody knows about suffering because we suffer all the time. But someone to suddenly say, wow, the reality of everything is freedom from suffering, cessation of suffering, nirvana, being blown away, suffering being blown away. That's unusual. In fact, that's unique. And particularly, it's unique because he stayed there saying it. In other words, he was here without saying it. Everything is fine, smiling. Happiness is reality. Unhappiness is ignorance. That's really what he's saying. So his compassion enables, so he sees, if you are a Buddha, you cannot attain nirvana yourself and leave other beings in suffering, leave them behind. If you do that, you're breaking your bodhisattva vow. You're saying, bye, I'm in nirvana, good luck. That's not possible. So what that means is that Shakyamuni Buddha, thousands of years ago in our time, under the tree, he saw all of us. And in those days, what were we? Maybe, I think I might have been a worm under the ground there, nearby the Bodhi tree. But he saw me as completely nirvana already. Because, you know, they say a Buddha has the knowledge of all three times simultaneously. So Buddha, you all know the story where Buddha remembered infinite previous lives of himself before nirvana. Then he remembered everybody else's infinite former lives. And then he became aware of all their future destinies. And then he attained nirvana. I think if you had to be aware of everybody, you might need nirvana rather urgently. So the point is, he saw us all as completely free already in his wisdom. But in his compassion, he noticed we didn't think so. We felt quite unhappy, and we do often feel that way, don't we? Except when we're in Riga, in the presence of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Otherwise, we tend to often feel unhappy. And then he said, well, too bad, because if you knew the truth about yourself, if you had wisdom instead of ignorance, you'd be totally happy already, here and now. But he realized he had to be practical. His compassion had him stay with us. His compassion had him set forth his teachings, share his mind through his speech. And we're still working on overcoming our ignorance. So many lives later, all of us. So in the Diamond Sutra, he says, you know, there is such and such, and there isn't such and such. And he sees both things simultaneously, is what we have to realize. He's not saying that what he's saying is meaningless. He's saying both things are the case. And luckily, the bliss side of the bliss-suffering equation is the more real one. That's the good news of the Buddha. That's why we like the Buddha, because he brought that news to, he always brings that news to the planet. So actually my title today, given to me by the great Julia, who is translating, I think, for those of you who speak Russian, which I apologize that I'm unable to do. She gave me this title, Sutra, Wisdom and Compassion in Sutra and Tantra. And it sounds like a grand title, But the reason for that, I guess, is we've been reading sutra, and we read also Jainampachi Tsongkhapa's enlightenment poem. I don't know if that was mentioned, but he wrote that poem on the morning of his full enlightenment. Being a great scholar and being a Tibetan and being a Buddha, he wrote down something right away. On the very morning, he wrote that praise to the Buddha for his teaching of relativity, of the teaching of relativity, Pratityasamutpada. So wisdom, first of all, sutra and tantra are the same thing, I wanted to say. A lot of people, unfortunately, think that tantra is some completely different thing that sort of has nothing to do with sutra. And sutra is some exoteric thing, and tantra is esoteric thing. And once you know about tantra, you don't even need sutra. And sutra is so boring and it'll never get you to tantra. People think that, but that's totally wrong also. And also Westerners, if you read history, they say Buddha, they even say that Buddha didn't even teach Mahayana Buddhism, non-dual, what we could call non-dual Buddhism. Buddha didn't even teach that. They made it up 400 years later. They don't believe Buddha himself and the many great masters, like these great masters of pandits of Nalanda, who, like the Tibetans, they have an individual vehicle vow. You know, they're monks, but they have a universal vehicle or Mahayana Bodhisattva worldview. And even they also know Tantra, and yet they're still monks, most of them. So they are living a unified thing, and they believe Buddha himself taught all three vehicles. He taught individual vehicle. I never say lesser vehicle. I don't like that. I say individual vehicle. A vehicle to freedom from suffering for the individual who seeks their own freedom, not because they're more selfish or anything, but because they don't think it's possible to help others free of suffering right away, so they seek just their own. Then universal vehicle is all the different individual vehicles, and each individual wants to help all the other ones from the beginning, so they become bodhisattvas. What? Oh, I'm too fast. I'm from New York. We talk fast. But I'll try to slow down. If I slow down, then I forget what I'm saying is the problem, because I'm older. Okay, I'll slow down, though. Sorry, Julia. So, but from the Tibetan point of view, from point of view of the Buddhist scholars and scientists, it's not possible to be a Buddha without teaching Theravada, individual vehicle, monastic Buddhism, Mahayana, Bodhisattva vehicle, and Vajrayana, Tantrayana, the esoteric vehicle. The only reason in history that the Buddha released, you know, those teachings more gradually after his own lifetime is that the society wasn't ready for these other teachings right away. They would have misunderstood them. For example, it's meaningless to take a bodhisattva vow, I'm going to save all beings from suffering, unless you already believe, from a practical point of view, that you have had many lifetimes and that you will have many more lifetimes. This is not a mystical belief from Buddhist point of view. This is a common sense scientific point of view based on people remembering previous lives, based on the idea that nothing is nothing. do we really know that? How many people here are afraid of nothingness? Show of hands. How many people are afraid of nothingness? There's a few. But I think maybe because you're mostly Buddhist, that's really good. The point is this, nothing, how can you be afraid of nothingness? It's nothing. If a commando, a marine, you know, a warrior, stood up and said, I'm afraid of nothing, what would that mean? That would mean they were not afraid. Because nothing is not fearful. It can't do anything to you. It's not there. Therefore, the scientist types who are materialists, who say they know that there's nothing after death, that when the brain stops and the heart stops, you become nothing. They are having only a blind faith belief, because no one ever discovered nothing. No one can prove nothing. Nothing is not there. That's a news flash. Nothing is nothing. So none of you, none of us, are ever going to become nothing. We are always going to become something else. This is like total common sense. But in our modern society, because of the authority of materialist science, we are conditioned to think, it's obvious I'll be nothing when I die. We may even think when we fall asleep at night that we just lie down and we become nothing for 8 hours or so, unless we have a dream. But otherwise, we're just nothing. But that's completely, we're not nothing when we wake up and we feel rested. So there's no way to be nothing, point of fact, actually. And the whole Buddhist path, of the Lam Rim path, stages of the path up to enlightenment, it all begins on the basis of realizing how precious you are as a human being, what they call the precious jewel of a human embodiment endowed with liberty and opportunity, which you personally have achieved. Your parents didn't make you. Buddha didn't make you. God didn't make you. You yourself evolved from other kinds of life forms, many previous times human life forms, and you're now so lucky to be this precious human being with the intelligence to come to Riga and listen to His Holiness the Dalai Lama's teaching. That makes you a unique, very rare person on the planet, seeking freedom, seeking happiness, seeking understanding, wisdom, and compassion. How many people are on a Sunday? Well, they hope that someone else will help them, people in many different religious institutions. They're hoping that someone else will help them find freedom someday. But they don't think they have the ability to find for themselves. They don't believe in their own intelligence has the ability to understand reality themselves, because the culture doesn't teach that. You can learn this science, you can learn this skill, you can learn, read Dostoevsky and learn this literature, but you'll never understand everything. Everyone told you that. But Buddhahood means you understand everything. That's what Buddhahood means. Omniscient. And every human being has that ability, according to Buddha. But they don't take advantage. But anyway, main point is, until you feel that's a common sense thing, until you feel that what you do right now will have an effect on you and other people and beings, not just humans, many lifetimes in the future, then there's no point taking bodhisattva. I'm going to save all beings. When are you going to have time? If you're nothing when you die, how can you save all beings? You can't possibly believe that yourself. Right? But if you're always going to be something, and not only that, everybody else is always going to be something, and you're going to be there with them forever. Members of your own family, all your friends, maybe your enemy. You're going to meet them again and again and again, life after life. And do you want to go through the same things with them that you went through always in the past? Would you like to see them completely happy so as at least then they wouldn't bother you? So you suddenly feel that you are interconnected through time with all beings. Like here we are, you know, we just met. And we all think probably we'll never see each other again, more or less. Maybe you'll come to New York. Maybe I'll come back to Riga or go to Moscow. But we sort of basically, okay, maybe bye, you know, good luck. But if we're reborn again and again, then we're going to constantly encounter each other. As they say in New York, we're going to be in each other's faces forever. So wouldn't you like to have everybody smile if you're in their face forever? So don't you want to smile at everyone, yourself, right? It changes the way you experience the present if you know that it goes on, its effect, its karma, its cause and effect go on endlessly. Then the only best way to be is to be everyone to be a Buddha, everyone to be enlightened, which means everyone to have perfect wisdom and perfect compassion and completely care and love everyone else. The worst way to be is everyone only to care about themselves and to feel that everyone else is against them. That's the worst possible universe, right? We're all in competition, no satisfaction. You'll never win against huge, infinite numbers of beings. You lose. That's the truth of suffering. You care for everyone and everyone cares for you. That's the best. So then you become automatically, the best logical thing is become bodhisattva. I vow to spend all my lives from now until eternity, Buddhahood, helping all other beings find their own Buddhahood and freedom from suffering. Right? That's bodhisattva attitude. Okay? Tomorrow, when you receive the sacred blessing, consecration of Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara, the god of wisdom, the god of compassion, then you, before, as you take, you recite bodhisattva attitude. So you don't feel it's a big risk or danger. It's a logical thing for you to do that when you know that you're stuck with all beings forever. You know, they say that a Buddha is a being who perceives every single other being, including non-human being, as a mother perceives her only most beloved child. Therefore, you know how as a mother with the child, you know, worries about the child, loves the child, feels identified with the child, is empathetic with the child. So a Buddha feels that way about everybody, which must be a very difficult thing to do, it would seem to us. You know, if we care about our family or our friend or our beloved, our lover, then we wouldn't want to feel that about the president or something. No, you know. But Buddha feels that way about everybody. Okay? So that's the one vision that Buddha taught, whether it was in the monastic vehicle or the individual vehicle, whether it was in the Mahayana universal vehicle, or whether it was in the Vajra tantric vehicle. It's all different ways by which a mother wants to help her child find their own happiness, which they have the right, they have the ability, they have the opportunity to do, but it requires education. So then Buddha becomes such a great teacher, Shasta. They say, Deva Manushyanam Shasta, or the name of Buddha, Lata Mi Dhamba, the teacher of humans and gods, is one of Buddha's important names, Deva Manushyanam Shasta.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations. podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded December 2018 during Professor Thurman's trip to Russia. To enjoy the full video version of this talk, please look in the podcast description. We'll include the link to the extended hour-and-a-half teaching presented in English to a Russian-speaking audience of those in attendance for teachings about His Holiness the Dalai Lama. The talk on wisdom and compassion focuses on the differentiation between sutra and tantra and the common threads in both, and how anyone from any tradition, Buddhist or not, can find value in the mind transformation teaching of the Buddha and his inner sciences. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including invites to special VIP events at New York City's Carnegie Hall, at Tibet House US, and at Menla Mountain Retreat in Phoenicia, New York, please visit tibethouse.us. Your tax-deductible donations help support the Tibet House mission of presenting and preserving Tibetan culture in the West. If you cannot donate, please be sure to share, comment, and like, and subscribe to the Bob Thurman Podcast on your favorite podcasting platform. Every share, like, and comment helps support this podcast. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about the work and music of Tenzing Chogyal, including his new album with Laurie Anderson and Jesse Paris Smith, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to this week's episode, which concludes with a special reading of the poetry of Hilda H.D. Doolittle by Gary Gock. Tashi Dilek, and thanks for listening.
So, wisdom and compassion in sutra. The one thing I just want to say about the wisdom in sutra and tantra, because it's same, there's no different one. Emptiness is same, voidness, reality, freedom, all of these are synonyms, really. And is this, you have the ability to embrace two opposite things in your mind at the same time, totally already. Every morning, you look at your face in a mirror. When you see your face in a mirror, you see a person in there who looks like they're on the other side of the window in another room. It's what you see. But you know that this is only a reflection of your face over here. And even left and right become reversed, and you correct that. So if you're a lady and you're putting on your eyeliner, you put it on your left eye when you see what looks like your right eye in the mirror. So you don't even think about it. You know that the left and right are reversed. So you have a simultaneous knowledge of two opposite things. It looks like another person in the mirror, and yet you know it's not. So my face is there, but it isn't my face. That's not rocket science. There's a marks of Buddha, and there are no marks of Buddha. The no marks of Buddha is emptiness, pure space, openness, freedom, in which there's just space for that. And the marks of Buddha are the reflected image. So the mirror surface is all of reality. It's the freedom of all reality, impermanence, emptiness, selflessness, whatever you want to call it. And so a Buddha just expands that. We automatically do that looking in a mirror. And a Buddha sees the whole world as reflected in the mirror of the body, his body of reality. And her body, of their female Buddhas also, of course. Her body of reality. So the Buddha shares his heart to everyone in everything that a Buddha does in order to have others wake up to the fact that a Buddha's heart encompasses all life. That the reality of all of us is that we are all a body of one life, as Shantideva says. You know, we are just one being, and every animal too, even insect, even micro-being. It's all one life form. But we are taught, we're frightened of that, we're taught that we're just separate us, and it's all against us. And so we have to conquer it or be conquered by it, and we never win that. But Buddha did win that. He became a Gyalwa, a Jina, a conqueror. He conquered that illusion, and he realized he was one with all life. And then he reveals it through these different things. He knows it with his wisdom, his transcendent wisdom, and he feels it with his compassion. He feels all of our feelings. And he knows, though, that our feelings of suffering are less real than the reality of our blissful freedom. It's because he holds them both in his mind at the same time. And this makes him the best doctor, the best teacher, because he can see our own potential of enlightenment in us already, in our own heart, in our own love. Have you ever been in love? Any of you? I hope so. I hope everyone has been in love. If you have, you had an experience at some point where you felt that your beloved was the same as you. You and your beloved were one being. It doesn't have to only be romantic. It can also be with an infant child, or sometimes some other kind of person, but or a horse even, or a dog, pet, cat. You just feel that that being is you. You identify with that being. You become empathetic to that being. So since we know we have that, then you will fall out of love, then you don't like, you have a divorce or something, and you don't like that person anymore. And so you withdraw that empathy and that identification. So we know we have the ability to expand and withdraw. What happens to a Buddha is that they expand that identification immeasurably, infinitely. And there's no withdrawing. They love everyone just that way. Which seems, of course, inconceivable to us, but that's how it is defined. And I hope it's true. You never know until you become one yourself, which I don't pretend to do. But I think so. I believe in that identification, personally. This is why His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, is so extraordinary. Because he does feel like that. I'm sure he would deny, oh no, like he might say, don't say a bunch of things. One time I introduced him when he first came to America at Harvard University. I introduced him in a really big way. And I said, here's the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, thousand arms, thousand eyes, and I went on. And then he came out, you know, after I introduced, and I walked off like you do, you know, when you shake hands with the person you introduced. And then he whispered to me, he said, you shouldn't give me such a big introduction, because I might disgrace you. I might be a big disappointment. He has such a good sense of humor. So I had more small, but he's not here, so I can introduce him more big. He's like, actually, my wife taught me that, actually. One time I was with a gentleman from, a Hindustani gentleman in New York, a wealthy gentleman, having a lunch. My wife was with me. And then his brother leaned and said, you know the Dalai Lama a long time. Have you ever seen him perform a miracle? And then I was hesitating because, you know, he is a kind of amazing, but you're not really supposed to talk about amazing things. So I was kind of not knowing sure what to say. And my wife immediately said, oh yes, many times. So then I said, uh-oh, what is she going to say? So then she said, then he's leaning like this, what? So then she said, I've been with him in many events as an organizer, which the organizers have a really hard job always, because there's so many people and His Holiness is so eminent and so wonderful, and you don't want him to get too exhausted and so on, so you're always worried about every little thing. I know we have organizers here and I know how they feel, what a wonderful job they do. And anyway, she said, I've been in him in so many situations where everybody wants his attention and wants a piece of him. And she said, I've never seen him ever once not give his full attention to whomever he was engaged with. Just completely focusing on them and what they need and what they want. I've never seen him do that. You know, like someone's here and looking there. So never. Always only paying attention to the person he's engaged with. And that's a miracle, she said. The guy was so disappointed. He wanted to see rabbit come out of a hat, you know, something magical. But she considered that magical, and so do I. And yet, and he's also always happy. He's always cheerful, His Holiness. And this is a man whose people are still being tortured and tormented. Their culture is still being locked down. He's still under a lot of pressure for people with a lot of need. And yet he draws happiness from reality, beyond life and death, from the true nature of reality, which is, you know, now let's move to Tantra, bliss void indivisible, bliss emptiness indivisible. That's what reality is at the highest expression. You know, when he first announced his Four Noble Truths, the Buddha, he just said freedom from suffering, nirvana, blown away suffering. Because he knew people would be suspicious if he said pure happiness. He wouldn't believe it. When do you believe pure happiness? Yourself. You know, I always say, people say, oh, I want to be happy, I want to be happy. But then, say you're home and your roommate, your husband, your wife, your child comes home and they say, I'm so happy. And then, I'm really happy. And then you say, well, why? Did you drink something? Are you all right? Is something wrong? Right? Happiness is a little bit illegal in most places. It's considered something against the law, you know, to be really happy for no reason. Just happy from inside. Happy because your heart is open. You feel the bliss of life. That's considered, maybe poets can do it, they can write about. But then the poet will get arrested if they go pronounce that in the street. So Buddha was careful. He just said freedom from suffering at first. But later when we come to Tantra, he's dealing with advanced student. People who already know, you have to know two things to do Tantra. You have to understand relativity. Meaning, you have lessened the tendency to fasten onto things as if they were absolute things. And what do I mean by that? For example, there's this glass of water here. And this is a glass that I didn't give to Priyadarshi. I'm just kidding. I have to tease him. Okay, but to me, this glass seems to be a real glass. You know, there's a magician. I know a magician, and he will eat the glass. He eats it, but not such a stick glass. But he will take a wine glass, and he'll eat it as a magic trick. You know, I don't know how he does it. He crunches it up. And just to show that it's not as solid as it seems. But to me, this seems like a real glass. It has what we call intrinsic reality in it. That is to say, the reality of the glass seems to come from out inside the essence of the glass. It isn't that I attribute a reality to it. It isn't that I engage with it. If a reality, you know, if it was shipped to me in a box, once it breaks, is it still a glass? You know, there's all these thought experiments we can do. But the emptiness of the glass just means that it's a relative thing. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means it only exists as a relative thing. And we know this actually already. This is one of the blessings of materialist science. You know, particle physics. From the point of view of particle physics, right, we know that this glass is made up of atoms and the atoms of subatomic particles, and that the atoms are mostly empty space and there's just a little thing zipping around in there, an electron, a nucleus. And so the picture that scientists has of the glass is very different from the solid sense of the glass that I habitually perceive. So we know already there's a kind of illusion in how we see things. But maybe then we think, well, it's really a bunch of atoms. But actually, from Buddha's point of view, he already discovered that, what the nuclear physicist discovered, thousands of years ago. And he saw through everything, even the atom. And the Buddhist great masters, they saw there was no such thing as an intrinsically real atom. Even all atoms come apart completely. And similarly, there's no intrinsically real mind either. So it's not like that means everything is just mental. It's not, you know, you can't find the mind, you can't find the matter. Neither one if you completely look for it. That's what emptiness means. But if you don't look for it, it's all relatively there. It's as simple as that, actually. And I will give this to Nancy later. Anyway, okay, so this is maybe hard for modern people to understand, that the Buddha was a greater scientist than Einstein. He discovered relativity long before, and he discovered it by using his own high-powered mind of samadhi, of concentration and analysis. You know, his ability to analyze things until they disappeared under analysis. And so we all have to have that experience a little bit. For example, you've all had an experience sometime in your life where your habitual sense of identity melted temporarily. Actually, we seek such experiences. When we go to a roller coaster for a thrill, when we have aesthetic experience, when we go to a rock concert, we say, you know, when someone comes from a rock concert where they hear Boris and he blows them away as they're dancing, and then they say, or Uma Thurman, or one of those Russian, or the U2, and they say, then you say afterwards, how were you? And they say, oh, I was blown away. So what do they mean by that? They mean that they just stopped being themselves for a short time, which they, of course, find somewhat boring, always being yourself. And then they just let themselves go with it, whatever, the music, the experience, the thrill, whatever it is. They just let go of themselves. And then they feel, when they let go of themselves, they suddenly feel better. Some energy seems to come from within their heart, within their cells, within their molecules. They don't know where, but it just seems to come up inside them and they feel energized and better. And the minute you stop having fun, it's what? It's when you think, how much fun am I having? The minute you think that, it's not enough. and you become dissatisfied again, right? Oh, it was better last concert, or I liked the other song better, or whatever it is. So this is the famous thing about source of all suffering is self-obsession, self-preoccupation, the self-identity habit. And the source of all happiness is love, concern, being concerned with others, and being feeling their feelings, and being worried about them, and forgetting about yourself temporarily. Then you feel better automatically. It's a very strange phenomenon which Shantideva is the great teacher of, and which His Holiness is the living representative, the agent. He's the super agent of Shantideva on the planet Earth nowadays. Totally. That's why we all love him so much, because he has opened that treasure of this, of the exchange of self and other. You know, when my common religion is the common human religion of kindness. When he said that to the world, you know, people just everywhere, even in communist China, they love it. They totally love it. So governments are afraid of him for that reason. So anyway, then we come to Tantra, okay? So now Tantra, one of my teachers, the late Tara Tulku, answered a question about Tantra and Sutra very, very brilliantly once that I always remember. What? What's that?
Just a bit slower.
Oh, slower, I'm sorry. Tantra. Tantra. Sorry, apologize. One of my teachers was asked, his name Tara Tulku, previous life, what's this, what is Tantra? And he said, in the sutra system, we cultivate wisdom to destroy the world of suffering by destroying its cause, which is ignorance. And while we're at it, we plant the seed of compassion by taking bodhisattva attitude, bodhisattva vow. What Tantra is rebuilding, taking the wisdom itself and rebuilding a better world for others out of the wisdom. So we take the liberating energy of the wisdom and we weave a new world, the world of the mandala, the world of the Buddha land, the Buddha field. We weave that new world so beings can have a better environment. Because, you know, Buddha is the supreme teacher. And if you're a teacher, for example, if you're teaching environmental science to your class, your words about the environment are valuable. And mathematics, which is just a language, your words, some pictures, is all good. But the ideal thing is to bring the student into the environment, into the swamp, into the forest, into the ice cap, into the ocean, and to let them feel connected to the environment. So you want to change the environment. A really great teacher will change the actual environment. So the student learns not just from the teacher's sharing mind through language, but also from the where they are, how they feel. And so the Tantra is opening a different environment. But it's considered, the reason that it's esoteric is that a person who has a very rigid imagination, a very fixed self habit, identity habit, rigid, I'm just me, and I'm exactly, this is my identity, and I only this way, and I'm not you, and this is my boundary. And if they're very, very rigid about it, and then you paint a picture of some fantastic, exquisite mandala, then they might take that rigid thing and attach it to that and become like psychotic. You know, get sort of crazy. It's all a mandala, you know, and they don't know where. They, an ability to be flexible and resilient. So that's why the prerequisite of Tantra is some degree of experience of selflessness. you know, I'm me and I'm not me. So some little hint that you're not you is essential, some negation. So then you're open to being, you're realizing that you're always changeable, you're open to being changed, you're open to being different than you think you are, and then you can explore the realm of cultivating a more positive imagination of the universe.
In 1944, H.D. wrote a book called Walls Do Not Fall during World War II. She was 56. I'll read a selection. There is a spell, for instance, in every seashell. Continuous, the sea thrust is powerless against coral, bone, stone, marble hewn from within by that craftsman, the shellfish. Oyster, clam, mollusk is master mason planning the stone marvel. Yet that flabby, amorphous hermit within, like the planet, senses the finite. It limits its orbit of being, its house, temple, fane, shrine. It unlocks the portals at stated intervals. Prompted by hunger, it opens to the tide flow, but infinity? No, of nothing too much. I sense my own limit. My shell jaws snap shut at invasion of the limitless ocean weight. Infinite water cannot crack me, egg in eggshell, closed in, complete, immortal, full circle. I know the pull of the tide, the lull as well as the moon. The octopus darkness is powerless against her cold immortality. So I, in my own way, know that the whale cannot digest me. Be firm in your own small, static, limited orbit, and the shark jaws of outer circumstance will spit you forth. Be indigestible, hard, ungiving, so that living within you beget self out of self, selfless, that pearl of great price. I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.